From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made in the 1980s with a number, 10%. This oft-repeated statistic is used to indicate that the percentage of people with eating disorders, this percentage, who are male. So 10% of all people with eating disorders are boys or men. Well, there's a problem. That number is entirely inaccurate. It came from a study that wasn't very clear, a study that was done during a time when few doctors or members of the public knew much about eating disorders at all. Another problem is that the number has been repeated in books, articles, and on websites for about 30 years. So it comes with some impacts. One is a sort of gender bias in research and treatment for people with eating disorders, and an increased stigma for men who suffer from anorexia, bulimia, or binge eating disorder. In reality, the percentage is much higher than 10%, but men often do not seek treatment because they're reluctant to ask for help. Instead, they suffer in silence. This is National Eating Disorders Awareness Week, and we thought it'd be an appropriate time to talk about the real data. And we'll also talk about what makes for effective treatment and how to lift the stigma of eating disorders. I'd like to welcome my guests for the hour. Mary Tantillo is a professor of clinical nursing at the University of Rochester School of Nursing. She's also the director of the Western New York Comprehensive Care Center for Eating Disorders, or WNYCCCED, and she's the founder of The Healing Connection. Long title, but well-deserved. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you for having us.
Michelle Morales is a parent peer mentor for WNYCCCED. Welcome back, Michelle.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Robin Giuliano is an advocate for eating disorder awareness and the owner of Snowbridge Books. Welcome, Robin.
Hi. Thank you for the opportunity.
And Genevieve Morrow is an advocate for eating disorder awareness as well. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me.
So, Mary, I'd like to start by correcting this picture, correcting this number. There are about 30 million people in the U.S. who struggle with eating disorders. What is the actual percentage of men and women? How does that break down?
It would, in the more recent study, it's really 25% men. And it kind of depends on whether you're doing the research study in the community or in a clinic. Because remember, of course, men feel shame for asking for any kind of help because that's how we socialize them. And unfortunately, men feel like this is a woman's illness because no one's, as you said, no one's really come out about how many men have this. And so they stay out of treatment. So if you do research in a clinic setting, you're going to see 1 in 10 instead of 25%, which exists in the community studies.
Mm-hmm. And so with the Healing Connection, if you were to break, well, let's talk about the Healing Connection for a moment. What is that?
So the Healing Connection is an amazing resource. It is the only intensive psychological program of treatment in our area. And it offers, now it offers, we're excited, we added an outpatient clinic. Just this week we had an open house. We now have a full arm of outpatient care, so partial hospital program, which runs like 5 days a week, 7 hours a day, which has everything you need there. Multifamily therapy, family, individual, group. We follow medication. We have a nutritionist. We have a lot of groups. And then we have an intensive outpatient program, which is also amazing. It's a step down from partial or a step up from traditional outpatient that runs 3 days a week, 3 hours a day. And we've purposely put it in the evening because people work and go to school, so they could also have treatment while they stay in the community. And now we just added, exciting, an outpatient mental health clinic. So you could actually move seamlessly. And you don't have to go out of town for treatment, hopefully, if you get good outpatient care. So it's an amazing place.
And that's so important because I think it was in 2010 when the Healing Connection was founded, there was a gap in the community with those types of resources. I think a few centers in Rochester had closed. The Buffalo Center had closed. So people were going to Syracuse or Pennsylvania in some cases to get treatment. When it opened, did you see an influx of people coming to you for assistance?
Yes, we did. Would have liked to see more guys, we're seeing more, trying to be helpful to more. But yes, people did come out, and more every year. It's been a little bit. We started out with probably 70 folks and only the partial hospital program. Now we see over 100 a year, probably. And now with intensive outpatient program, I think we probably served at least, well, I'm just going to guess, 70 people or so. And now we're going to open up the outpatient clinic, and we hope to serve more patients and families. And we serve ages 12 and older, and we're very family-based there.
We'll talk about that more later in the hour because there's some incredible research that you sent my way. You sent a lot of homework for me. Thank you for that.
Yes.
But it's all very important, and I think our listeners will benefit from hearing it. But let's go back to some statistics for a moment. Eating disorders have the highest mortality rates of any mental illness. When you're working with families, and I'll open this up to everyone, Is that on your mind? Are you scared that you might lose a loved one? Or Genevieve and Robin, were you worried about yourself in that respect, or were you more focused on the immediate circumstance when you were seeking treatment?
I mean, I personally didn't even really consider that I could die, because you're just so in it, and your brain is so starved that it's just reality doesn't really exist for you. Obviously, my parents were concerned about it and tried to bring it to my attention, but I just didn't see it.
Let's talk about your story. So when did you first notice that things were changing, or did you not notice and your parents were pushing you to seek some help?
It's kind of tough. I mean, I remember a health class where we were talking about eating disorders, and as I've said, I was kind of going through the checklist of everything that qualifies you for an eating disorder. I was like, no, that wouldn't happen to me. I wouldn't have an eating disorder. So I went on for about 8 years before I was actually diagnosed, and I was able to convince my parents that I didn't have an eating disorder, so they didn't drag me in. And finally, eventually, they did, but it took a while.
How old were you?
I was 17 at that point. It was my senior year in high school.
Mm-hmm. And what were you diagnosed with?
It's one of the more complicated ones. It's actually, people call it EDNOS, or eating disorder not otherwise specified. Mm-hmm. In the mental health, the DSM, each disease kind of has very specific guidelines for diagnosis, and I didn't fit neatly into any of them. So I had anorexia theoretically, but my BMI was not low enough for me to qualify. I wasn't binging when I was purging, so I didn't qualify for bulimia. But I did have the obsessive exercise piece, so they just kind of stick us all in category where those of us that don't fit neatly go.
Mm-hmm. And Mary's nodding. Mary, you want to?
I was going
to
say most human beings don't fit in boxes. Like probably up till the most recent DSM-5, the psychiatric bible, we changed some of those things for all the reasons Jen just said. But lots of people fell into that eating disorder not otherwise specified category. We've helped that because now we've actually said that binge eating disorder is a legitimate problem that human beings suffer with, so that was pulled out. So there's hopefully less people will not have a place, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, Robin, go ahead.
Sure. Well, mine is kind of a layered approach because I come from a history of recovering from drugs and alcohol. And so in that process, from the outside, there's kind of a notion that, you know, I mean, people can die with a needle in their arm, but food can't really do anything to
it. Right, a huge misconception. Yeah.
And yet I would have personal experiences where I knew that there was just resonating inside that I was killing myself with food. Mm-hmm. And for me, I, not solely because of my eating disorder, but my eating disorder was a contributing factor. I ended up on dialysis, which brought my mortality in. Resonating a little deeper within my being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've talked a little bit about your story off the air, and I want to go through that because I think people will benefit from hearing how one thing may lead to the next, and we'll sort through all that. But going back to you, Genevieve, you mm-hmm. sought treatment outside of this area, correct?
Right.
Okay.
When I was diagnosed officially, it was in October of 2008, and as we were saying, at the end of December 2008, the partial program in Rochester, excuse me, closed. So I unfortunately had like 2 months to get into that program, and insurance denied my request to get in, most likely because I didn't fit neatly into one of those categories at that point. And they also said that I hadn't tried hard enough in recovery, whatever that would mean. So I ended up just sliding down a hill and getting worse and worse, and eventually I had to go to an inpatient facility in Philadelphia because there just weren't options here.
I want to go back to what you said about not trying hard enough. Mary, you're shaking your head. Is that something you hear often with insurance companies?
Sadly, not just insurance companies, but people, a lot of us who are uneducated about the illness. Some people will think people do this on purpose. They wake up in the morning and don't eat or throw up, or they think it's vanity. This has nothing to do with vanity. This is a legitimate mental health issue that has biological, psychological, social, cultural, high risk factors that come together and create problems. And lots of people don't know that. And insurers, luckily Excellus in town doesn't think this way. They're a major champion. But like lots of insurers base your progress on weight. Hmm. And sadly, in the DSM that Jen was talking about, there were the first criteria for anorexia till the, recently, because we changed it, was the inability to be at least 85% of your weight for height. And that's baloney, because you can be in a lot of trouble with your thoughts, as these guys will tell you, and not necessarily have to lose down to 85%. So it's not all about weight. And weight should not be used as an indicator for success. It's one criteria, but really it's more about information processing, regulating your emotion, feeling in control, feeling good about yourself. They're nodding. They're going to tell you more about
good,
that.
Good, good. Please do.
One thing I'd like to say is that Jen also brought up, like, she didn't look the part. So that's a stigma that we're trying to get around very much. So a lot of people don't look like they have an eating disorder. You would never know. It's their thoughts. And we're hoping to change that so people can get the help that they need.
And Michelle, you and your daughter were on this program in 2015 talking about your story. Is that something you experienced with Alyssa? Did she not look the part? How did you know that something was going on?
She did have anorexia, but I noticed the changes before all of the weight loss started. So I was able, we had a good relationship, and she did help me to understand it was her thinking that was starting to get in the way. Mm-hmm. And then the weight loss came off. So initially, no, she was a normal 12-year-old, you know, trying to make it through adolescence at that point. And it wasn't until the weight loss.
Mm-hmm. Genevieve, Robin, yes, go.
Yeah, well, I just have a comment because I've been thinking about it over the last few days. I have a diagnosis of morbid obesity. I'm a very large man. And even with that visible sign, I would say to people, including my physician, that I had an eating disorder because I knew I had many, many years of struggling with addiction. I knew what the deal was within myself. And they think would just kind of go, well, it's just obesity. And obesity is often framed as a moral disorder, as what you were just saying, Mary, is not, you know, it's actually a thing that has, you know, biological, psychological, social, cultural factors. But the eating disorder that was like driving my weight gain was kind of sloughed aside, and it was just thought of a thing of personal agency or moral imperfection or... And so even professionals didn't really understand. So sometimes it's not visible and not recognized, and sometimes it's visible and still not recognized.
Right. Well said.
So what was the biggest challenge for you, Robin? Was it finding someone who could help you, or did you have to do a lot of work on your own to pursue treatment?
Well, I did. I was on dialysis, and I could not control my fluids.
Let's start from the beginning, because I think it's important to work our way toward this. So your journey began when you were about 7.
Yeah.
Okay, tell us about that.
Well, at 7, I used to, like, steal money and wait for the school bus, and there was a little country market, and I would go in there, and I would eat Hostess fruit pies and candy and everything, and what I realize now is even then there was some... There was trauma, there was abuse, there was emotional abuse, there was a neglect, there was a starving for attention, which is an interesting phrase to even use, right? And so I used the food to regulate my emotions and to my comfort level and to kind of get out of the uncomfortability I was in. And at the same time, at 7, I first started smoking pot, and by 11, I was drinking and drugging on a daily basis. And so then I left food. And I was, you know, I was actually really skinny for many, many, many years because I didn't really eat. I would, if I had a choice between drinking and drugging and eating, I was always going to be drinking and drugging and running on the street. And then when I got sober, about 20 years later, I started to try to get sober. I put down the drugs, I put down the alcohol, I quit smoking cigarettes, and I went back to food. Yeah, so that was the thing. It was kind of my first drug of choice, and... it's the one I ended up with. Yeah. And I was, so I wanted to say, because I couldn't control my fluids, sugar, pop, juice, milk, anything with sugar. And I was just so thirsty that I would drink. And when you're on dialysis, you have a limitation of your fluid intake. And I would go in with these really high gains, like maybe say 8 liters, which is about 18 pounds you could gain overnight. And then they could maybe only take like 5 or 6 off. And then you go and gain another 8. That's a fast track to the hospital with congestive heart failure. So I would say to the doctors, I can't control my fluid intake. I say I'm not going to do it. I do it anyhow. I say I'm not going to do it. I do it anyhow. And the, you know what he said to me? He said, well, that's really great that you're honest about it, because nobody really is. Few people are very honest about you. You're so honest, and you're so rare a case of that, that there's no help for you. That's what he said.
And I was, how does that happen?
I felt sick because it was like a compliment for being honest. And yet then I was like left in the lurch with like, well, that's too bad. And so I said something to another doctor there of what the one doctor said. And he said, well, you're going to have to do something on your own.
Okay. I have to admit, I am very ignorant of the healthcare system. Yeah. But that just, that makes no sense to me. Mary, how does something like this happen?
I think that we need to educate people more. Hold on for one second. We need to educate people more about the illness. At the Healing Connection and the Western New York Comprehensive Care Center for Eating Disorders, we think of eating disorders as diseases of disconnection. Here's a great example of disconnection, which I don't think any provider means to create disconnection, but it's a lack of education and not knowing the resources, not understanding the illness. And things like Project Echo that we're offering through Western New York Comprehensive Care Center, we're trying to pull together behavioral health therapists, primary care providers, college providers, and teach them through video conferencing how to think about the illness so that they kind of know. And as a, you know, as a primary care provider, for example, if you don't know something, you get really nervous. You don't want to not know. At the same time, you have to be aware, if you don't know, you have to know where to go to help patients and families, because isolation, and they'll tell you this, isolation is something that the illness breeds. And it also, it's like jet fuel for eating disorders. When you're isolated, it wants you isolated, it wants you all to itself. And as Jen already said, and Robin's alluded to, it just kind of takes you over so that you get disconnected from what's genuine. Your thoughts, your feelings, your needs, your real goals and aspirations in life. And then it separates you from not only yourself, but from other people. And mm-hmm. providers don't know how to think about this. We have to continue to do more education.
Listeners, if you'd like to join this conversation, you can call 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can also email the program at connections@WXXI.org. Or you can find me on Twitter at mmacmedia. So let's revisit the disconnection piece. I had the privilege of reading Mary's papers about a disease of disconnection. And I want to turn to Michelle, because you're working with parents across our region who may not quite understand that concept, and you're watching your child struggle, and you've experienced this in person. How do you forge that connection? How do you help a parent understand what this disease is really about, this disorder?
I have a great opportunity to be working with the families, and the first thing I do is explain to them that it is a disease of disconnection, and then I explain what that means. And when I start explaining, you see the lights go on in all of their eyes, because the isolation piece, yes, all of a sudden their child is isolating for hours and hours on end. And one family would say, well, isn't that what an adolescent is supposed to do? And I said, no, not really. Not when they're spending their entire day and not wanting to participate with their friends, not wanting to go out and have fun, not wanting to be a part of the sports or any other, or being in the theater. And even in the family, they should be, you know, at least if that isn't, you know, going on. And when they're home, they're not interacting with their family members. So I explained then, okay, so we need to help your child with connection. And that means, first of all, getting them the treatment that they need so that they can start to start that recovery process. And then what that means is you get them the help that they need, and then we start the repair work that needs to be done within the family.
Genevieve, how did you find that connection for yourself?
Oh, gosh, it was tough. I'll start by saying that actually the Healing Connection is the first program that really brought that to light. There were some family groups at the Renfrew Center that I attended, but really it was just, you know, focusing on you and things like that. And, you know, it's also hard because the disease is so shameful to the people who are struggling with it. So you don't want to talk to your parents or your siblings or your friends, you just don't want to bring that up. And I initially really resented the Healing Connection for making me talk about it, because it was awkward. And eventually they teach you how to do it. I don't know if that answers your question, but the group, the multifamily group, kind of shows you how to open up that communication again. So just like you would talk about school or having a stomach ache, you would talk about, you know, when you're having a bad day or when you're struggling, what your family can help you do at the table. For instance, after dinner, at some point I read a study that showed after 15 minutes your food is digested. So in my mind, that kind of made it into, well, it's not worth purging. So I communicated with my family, and after dinner meals, we would sit there together for 15 minutes until I got there, and then it was safer. I mean, that's just one example that comes to mind.
Did you feel that by confronting the disorder, you were sort of tackling a piece of yourself? Did you identify so much with your disorder that you felt like maybe you were losing a piece of yourself if you were to disconnect from it?
Oh, my gosh. Yes. I struggled with the disease for so long, and I think even people who haven't, it just becomes who you are. And my identity kind of became the girl with an eating disorder. And in my sickness, I saw that as a positive thing. Like, I was the girl who had control and had that eating disorder, and I was different from other people. And if you look at statistics, I'm really not, because there are so many people out there who are struggling that you're not different. But it was my coping mechanism. It was my identity. And when I first went into treatment, I thought people were trying to rip it away from me, and I didn't know who I was without it, because my whole childhood and my whole adolescence had been the eating disorder, to the point where, you know, you forget your memories. They say that you don't grow socially from the point you start the eating disorder until you're in recovery. So I didn't know how to handle things even. It was really hard.
Mm-hmm. Robin, did you experience that?
Well, I want to go back to the connection piece, because sure. I look at it on a little bit of a different level. And I'm going to take a risk here, and I'm going to just disclose that, you know, I was sexually abused as a young child. And I think that not all people who have eating disorders that were sexually abused, but some were. Mm-hmm. And I think that that may be one of the aspects that keeps males relatively silent about stepping up and acknowledging the fact of an eating disorder. But with that came a whole disconnection from my whole body. I'm still working on like the process of like connection between like with myself, if there is a notion of an authentic self, of a being truer to my own values, to living a life that allows me to feel good about myself. But I mean, when you're at the basic level where you're disconnected from your own body, right, and then just kind of like circles of context from yourself, your emotional, psychological self, and then from other people, and then the identification with the disease, right, is usurping your whole being, mm-hmm. and isolating you and disconnecting you and keeping your guard up. Mm-hmm. So the whole like process of reconnecting with oneself throughout the process of healing is central, I think. Mm-hmm. And it can't be done alone. It has to be done within a community of support.
Which is your fear.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? The thing you need to do is the thing that's terrifying, because mm-hmm. you can't find yourself without others. It's a great paradox.
It sounds like it's like when you throw a pebble in the middle of a puddle and the ripples get further and further apart. Is there some technique that you use at the Healing Connection to try to draw people back in? I mean, what's the number one thing that you think helps people make that transition? Mary.
So at the Healing Connection, like Jen and Robin talked about, the model is that it's a disease of disconnection. So the fulcrum or the heart of what we do, which is going to sound so easy, but is not, it's like a life work, is mutuality and motivation. Like, you have to understand, like when you hear Robin and Jen's stories, like what are the motivators for the behaviors? Well, Robin's saying that he had trauma. Like, I'd want to protect myself from the rest of the world, too, and from my body, which I, P.S., couldn't control because somebody else was hurting it. And, you know, if you have to figure out what's the purpose of the illness so you can help the patient safely figure out other ways to meet those needs and to serve those, to get those purposes served. And so mutuality is really just, not just, but it's a back and forth flow of thoughts, feelings, activity. It's being able to not only like the other person because they're similar, but to respect them for their differences. It's mutual empathy, going both ways, empowerment, practicing being clear about who you are, who the other person is, what the relationship is about. And basically, I don't think it's a technique so much as it's a way of being. We train the staff. So I'll give you a quick example because it's hard to put into words. But like, if I'm talking to Jen in a therapy session or Robin, and And I'm asking them what they're feeling, their eating disorder prevents you, stops you from processing and knowing really what's going on inside, which adults don't understand. They think, well, that's easy. You can just say how you feel. But you can't when you have an eating disorder, because truly inside, there's like a disconnect literally going on in the brain too, and your gut, you don't know. So they might, I might say, well, how are you feeling right now? And they might say, I don't know. So then I can say in a mutually empathic way, well, when I'm witnessing what you're experiencing, I'm starting to feel really sad. I'm feeling the tears well up my eyes. I'm feeling my chest get heavy, like there's an anvil on it. And then the patient can hear that and they can bring that in and empathize with themselves and say, you know what? Am I feeling what Mary's feeling? Am I feeling sad? Well, maybe I guess I'm feeling also kind of disappointed, or maybe I'm feeling a little annoyed. And then the patient brings it back out between the two of you. And it's that back and forth. And so that's, I think, at the heart. If you don't have that, you can use all the cognitive behavioral treatment, all the dialectical behavior treatment that you want in the world, which is, those are very important treatments. But without that basis of a relationship, I don't think you're going to get anywhere.
I'm seeing the phone starting to ring. Keith, we'll get to your call in just a minute, but let's stay on this subject for just one moment, because I think that ties into the role of parents and caregivers. How does that work when you're at the Healing Connection, for example? Are parents sitting with their children in some of these sessions and meetings, or how do you build this relationship?
As a parent, that was my favorite part, actually, of the Healing Connection. There are lots of opportunities. The first is obviously family therapy with the individual therapist. So the families are brought in, and as Jen said, they're given these little nuggets of education that help to support their child. And then the Healing Connection offers a parenting group where it's just the parents that come together and discuss the challenges that they're seeing at home, and, you know, getting other people's, view of things and what they did to help with that, which then they can take home and they can have this wealth of information. And then finally, the great piece is when we bring everyone together, multi-family, so that's the patients as well as the families. And it's this just beautiful, wonderful session where the families are hearing from patients, not just their own child, because sometimes we get caught up in just, you know, hearing the eating disorder and we don't always hear our child. So we have the opportunity to hear from the patient's point of view, what they're experiencing and what they need help with. And it also, I believe, gives the patients an opportunity to hear from the families, the struggles and the challenges and how much they just truly love their child and they just want to be there for them. They don't mean to make mistakes, or they don't mean to do the wrong thing. They don't know what to do, and they're just looking for help. So it's wonderful.
Can I?
Sure.
I just want to add to the other great thing that we have here in Rochester, and Michelle also is a part of that, is the Western New York Comprehensive Care Center. So the Healing Connection is an affiliate in the Western New York Center, which lives at the School of Nursing and is a partnership between Gallus Island Children's Hospital Adolescent Eating Disorder Program and the School of Nursing. And Michelle also is able to follow these families because of the grant in the center, which is your tax dollars from the Department of Health. She can follow people out of the Healing Connection into the community and provide transitional services that insurers don't pay for. So you can actually keep that connection going beyond the Healing Connection into the community, or from one level of care to the other. We also have a life coach. We have a care manager. We have a young adult peer mentor. We have a whole host of people outside the Healing Connection who work with the Healing Connection staff through the School of Nursing that actually can keep that connection going. So we're very lucky. Most states don't have a setup like this.
I'm late for our only break of the hour. This hour is flying by. So we'll take that very quickly. When we come back, I'd like to talk about some myths of eating disorders, and we'll focus more on the male component because I think that's not discussed enough. Our guest this hour, Mary Tantillo, a professor of clinical nursing at the University of Rochester School of Nursing, also the director of the Western New York Comprehensive Care Center for Eating Disorders, and the founder of the Healing Connection. Michelle Morales is a parent peer mentor for WNYCCED. Robin Giuliano is an advocate for eating disorder awareness and owner of Snowbridge Books. And Genevieve Morrow, an advocate for eating disorder awareness as well, sharing their stories today. Short break, more connections next. I'm Megan Mack. Monday on The Next Connections, if you were born into the 1%, would you think about giving away your inheritance? That's what author Chuck Collins did at age 26.
Now he's an expert on tackling inequality. We'll talk with him about his new book, Born on Third Base. Then in our second hour, the science behind recovering text from damaged scrolls. We'll talk about imaging science and its impacts. That's Monday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson today. Let's go right to the phones. First up is Keith in Brighton. Hi, Keith.
Megan, how you doing?
Okay.
I've been listening, and I haven't heard anything, and you're talking about eating disorders, but do they consider somebody who eats to the excess if they become morbidly obese an eating disorder?
Go ahead, Mary.
So that's a very good question, and it's a little bit complicated. So if you looked at the DSM-5, which is the Bible, basically, that psychiatrists use to diagnose eating disorders, you have an eating disorder if, for example, with anorexia nervosa, if you kind of overvalue and judge yourself based on your body shape and weight. That can happen in binge eating, too. It doesn't always happen. But in binge eating disorder, you are using food as a comfort, as a means of controlling life, as a means of maybe connecting, taking care of yourself. It's backfiring, but it's helping you calm down and deal with intense emotion. But in order to get, for example, the classification of binge eating disorder, you would have to be binging, and they will describe exactly what that is in the DSM, which is eating a large amount of food in a circumscribed period of time, which would be larger than what anybody else in your situation would eat at that time. And the key hallmark of binge eating is that you're also feeling a lack of control. If you don't meet all those criteria, you won't technically, as Jen said, meet binge eating disorder. It does not mean that you're not suffering, because you could actually be suffering and having emotional overeating and not necessarily, quote, meeting binge eating disorder. It doesn't mean you're not suffering, though. Is this helping answer your question?
No, not really. I see you're looking at it from a clinical perspective, but I'm looking at it more of a practical perspective. It's an eating style or an eating habit that is basically killing you slowly. And this day and age, obesity, and we're not even going into the morbidly obese, is a very, very big problem. And it's getting more and more pushed on the shoulders of society. I know several people, I know many people who work in the medical field, and a lot of people's problems now, their health problems, can be traced back to obesity.
Yeah, you're making
eating too much.
Yes, you're making a very good point. So obesity is considered a physical health problem, and there's many roads into obesity. One of those roads could be through binge eating disorder, but other people have, you know, struggle with obesity not because they have binge eating disorder or even emotional overeating. It may be just that what they're eating is outweighing their activity level. And some people actually have, there's genetic predisposition, there's all different kinds of obesity. So you really have to have a good workup with a primary care person and a behavioral health person to look at, is your overeating, is it truly binge eating in the way that psychiatry would look at it? And I don't like putting people in boxes, as Jen said, but is it really that? Or is it that you're eating to excess and your activity level is not matching that? There's different ways in. About 25 to 30% of people in weight management university-based clinics have binge eating disorder. Whether anybody knows that or not is a different issue. So it's a little bit complex, and I'm not meaning to sidestep, because you're right, obesity is an issue, and you can have obesity and an eating disorder at the same time, or you may not have both of them. They can, and the treatment's going to be different depending on what the inroad is to the obesity.
Mm-hmm. Keith, does that answer your question?
Okay, thank you.
Yep, thanks for calling, Keith. So let's talk about the DSM. That's a term we keep hearing. For those that may not understand what that is, let's just do an overview of the DSM.
The DSM is a Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which helps, it's kind of a book of diagnoses and different criteria that you have to meet, whether it's depression or an eating disorder or an anxiety disorder. It kind of is a classification. And having said that, human beings are way more complex than the criteria in the DSM. The good news about the DSM-5 is it's loosened up and broadened so that people aren't just coming up with these ideas that, well, you have to meet a certain weight criteria. It's kind of broadened the criteria, and it even dropped that you had to lose menstrual periods, because guess what? Guys don't get them last time I looked. So,
but bone density, that's something you talked about the last time you were on the show. So that's something.
Bone density, men and women can suffer when they're not, when they're malnourished. It only takes 6 months of poor eating to get osteopenia. And full-blown osteoporosis, which is very bad bone density, will happen like after that. But it only takes 6 months to hurt your bones. And if you're between 17 and 22, your peak bone mass growth is during those years. And that's where a lot of eating disorders happen. Some happen a lot younger. Some happen older. But bone mass can be hurt really badly. And both genders struggle with that.
Up next on the phone is Ron in Mendon. Hi, Ron.
Hi. A friend of mine went through an eating disorder issue for quite some time, and she was a colleague at work, and she eventually invited a lot of us who worked with her to her group therapy sessions, and the underlying theme that continually materialized for people who were suffering with bulimia, anorexia, bulimorexia, so on and so forth, was anger. And the therapist, and there were several of them, and they came and they went because the period was extended, all affirmed that anger is the core issue with any eating disorder. Anger at not having the right body type, anger at their significant others, anger at their parents, anger at their peer group, anger at everything else that's floating around in the culture and society. And it was when they got involved in primal screen therapy, which was very illuminating, the disorders essentially vaporized. And the issue then became, is the eating disorder a permanent malady? Is the eating disorder, is it a temporary situation, whether it's a week, 2 weeks, does it come, does it go? And the consensus, by way of the therapist, and this was done down in the Washington Psychiatric Center and the Washington Hospital for Eating Disorders and whatever, well, it is, in effect, a temporary thing. It can be a temporary thing.
Okay,
and
Ron,
I just, my last statement is I'm hearing an awful lot of the what's, what it is, and so on and so forth. I need to hear from your guest's perspective why it is what it is.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Ron. Thanks for the call. So you've given us a lot to talk about. There have been some visceral reactions. So let me start with Mary. Go ahead, Mary.
There are so many different directions I could go with this. So anger can be one issue that can be fueling an eating disorder, but it could also be a real sense of a lack of safety that comes with trauma and an inability to be safe and connected with others. It could be depression, and it could be perfectionism. It could be, it's usually a ton of anxiety, obsessionality, worry, very low self-esteem, self-hate. And it's not usually a passing thing. I guess maybe it seemed like it was passing because she had a lot of treatment. And if you think about an onion, there's many layers to an onion, right? So the eating disorder may be at the outermost layers. And you can treat people to get them to stop certain eating behaviors. You can lock them in a room in a treatment program, help them stop purging, help them gain weight. And then when you do that, as Robin said, now you're sitting with the raw feelings. When you stop drug and alcohol use, or when you stop binging and purging and restricting, now you're sitting with all the intense emotion. And for this person that you're talking about, her strongest emotion might have been anger. And now you have to look that in the face, and now you have to deal with that. It's not that it makes the eating disorder like it wasn't there. The eating disorder is a manifestation of things that run into it. All right, so whether that's uncertainty, perfectionism, anxiety, anger, now you're in that layer, and the patient can do therapy on whatever is kind of the creek running into the ocean that led to the eating disorder. And also, there's neurobiology that has to do with this. You're saying you wanted to know why. There's some research now that shows that a part of our brain called the insula, there may be a disconnection in that part of our brain. And why that's important is that the insula is able to take outside information, which through our senses. So let's say you walk into a room and all of a sudden the lights go out. And when your brain's working properly, your insula takes in all your sensory information, what you're seeing, what you're hearing, what you're smelling, and that, you know, that sick feeling you get in your stomach when the lights go out, it's able to take what's going on inside your body in your organs and put all that information together so you can adequately process what's going on, not only around you, but inside of you. And there's a theory now that there's a disconnect. The insula and the circuits coming into that area might not be, the information's not being synthesized. So you can't really tell what you're feeling exactly. Are you feeling emotional fullness? Are you feeling physical fullness? Are you feeling emotional hunger? Are you feeling physical hunger? What is that facial expression that my therapist has right now? The therapist might have a neutral facial expression, but because you've lost your inner compass, your insula and its ability to synthesize, you're looking at your therapist's face and you're reading it as anger. You're looking in the mirror and you're seeing yourself as bigger than what you are, or you're experiencing your body as bigger than what it really is. So it's very complicated, but I wouldn't say eating disorders are temporary, because they're not just about eating. They're about information processing, regulating emotion. And I think Jen and Robin could probably speak to this better, but I'm hoping this is helping what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you, Mary. Did Genevieve and Robin, did you want to jump in?
I can add to the anger piece.
Sure.
A lot of eating disorders are developed around coping with things, particularly, as everyone has said, negative emotions. So when you develop your eating disorder, just like you stop developing socially, you really cut off your connection with yourself and identifying your emotions, and you can't really learn how to do that. And at least in my experience, and I think it's been a lot of people, when you first, all the symptoms are dealt with and you start feeling those emotions, a lot of the emotions come out as anger. So I couldn't identify things, which would also frustrate me, and I would just be angry, and it could have been anything else, but I would just start yelling and be angry at people and my family and myself. And later on I learned that it's not anger, and you have to look a little deeper to figure it out, but that's mm-hmm. how it manifests itself.
Mm-hmm. Robin.
I think a discourse that attributes the centrality of anger as the causative agent is really limited. For a number of reasons. One, behind anger, not to say that anger isn't present, you know, for being experiencing trauma, for being held hostage by an addiction, there is anger. But behind anger are refined emotions of our being that we can learn about if we're given the opportunity to do so. And so to just cap it off at anger and not to like dig deeper and find out, you know, is there fear? Is there doubt? Mm-hmm. Is there anxiety? So that the more subtle, like, and the other thing is that it ties with that discourse that the only emotions that males can experience is anger. It's kind of a limited view. And the other thing is, and not to say that primal therapy wouldn't have its usefulness, I think it was Janoff or whatever, but a lot of times when they come up with a therapeutic intervention, like if all you have is a hammer, then everything is a nail. So sometimes it will be backwards. They'll come up with a therapeutic intervention, and then all the diagnoses that will lead to that are kind of centered around the tool that you're using as an intervention. And I think to have a more diverse, comprehensive approach to, and the other thing is that each individual is particular.
Right.
So you have to look
at. Don't put people in a box, as Mary said earlier.
You have to look at, like, you know, each case. And so I wouldn't say that just one thing was the central causative element. I wouldn't want emotion.
Mm-hmm. But picking up what Robin said, primal scream therapy will help you discharge literally the tension that goes along with anger. But as Robin said, you want to keep going, because that's usually an end point, not a beginning. You have to keep going upstream, because there might have been hurt, betrayal.
For my daughter, anger came out whenever she was shame triggered, which makes sense because who wants to feel shame? So I'm just going to throw it back at you. So that was one thing that she finally had to come to terms with, that every time she did have an outburst of anger, it was because she was shame triggered.
And Michelle, that makes so much sense, because people who have eating disorders are wired in a way that they're perfectionistic, they're hard on themselves, they're full with anxiety, and they worry about things, and then they don't do well with intense emotion. So it doesn't take much to, in our society anyway, when you're already feeling like that and your self-esteem's not so hot, to feel triggered. And just so people know that eating behaviors are like at the bottom of the creek, right? They're the final manifestation of all the things that we've talked about. Because just like primal screaming can get away, can get off the tension of the anger, binging and purging can also take the edge off of those things. Or restriction can make you not feel. It's numbing. It serves a protective purpose. It backfires in the end. But it's a way to kind of get day to day when you feel like you're in a free fall and you're frightened. You're frightened of ambiguity, uncertainty, unpredictability, and that is life. And so you really feel limited in your ability to feel effective. And so that's really what an eating disorder is about. It manifests itself in these symptoms that we all get distracted by. And of course, we have to feed people and we have to get rid of binging and purging and food restriction. That is like the very beginning of a long story. So think about onions. That's how you want to think about it, layers of things.
Mm-hmm. We're down to our last few minutes already. A couple listeners have asked for an email address to email the program. The easiest one is just connections@wxxi.org. I can see that. Also, my email address is mmack, so mmack@wxxi.org. Or you can call. We still have time for maybe one more call, 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. During the break, we were talking about some other emotions and some very specific words, shame, guilt, stigma. I want to turn this over to Robin and Genevieve. Which or more of those words did you identify with during your journey?
All of them. Mm-hmm. all of them. I don't know if you felt the same way, Robin.
Yeah, I just go back to humiliation, mm-hmm, and being humiliated and humiliating others and seeing other people humiliated, and then the shame of not being able to control my own behavior. And how deep, like, to even get those to the surface is an arduous task, right? I could see why it'd be easier just to have anger, right, than to dig into, like, the shame-based stuff that is going on.
Did you feel like it was more difficult for you because, you know, the number one myth on Mary's sheet here, eating disorders only affect wealthy teenage girls. Did you experience any of that?
It's funny. I've had a long history of being like, one of these things doesn't fit like the others. I've been in groups. And so I went in there and I'm like largely obese and will eat anything. And I'm with these tiny, in my mind, girls who have a hard time eating anything. So it was like the opposite of everybody I was with. But I had a clear understanding of my need and desperation. And so that kind of erased a lot of the differences. It didn't matter to me. I just really was kind of scrambling to get better. And I've been at that point before with different substances. And I think when you're in that point of either pain or recognition of your need or the powerfulness of the disease and what you're up against, that you're willing to cross some bridges that formerly might have put me off. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, make this, the onus of responsibility for me to connect in a realm of superficial differences is on me if I want to get better. That's a certain point of recovery that not everybody is actually at, I don't think. I mean, it mm-hmm. took me many years to kind of get to that point.
But you could see how if we're so harmed in relationship, how the brain can literally wire up to protect you from even pursuing relationship. Like when kids are growing up, you're actually... When you're a teenager, you're actually putting together, your reward pathways are forming. And so he was hurt so early on. His brain literally developed pathways that felt more connected to food, more comfort, more safety, more connection, literally. Sure. And then neurologically it gets, you know, your neurons are connecting up like this, forming those pathways. You could see why you would gravitate towards food instead of people. It was safer. Mm-hmm. You could control it. And it goes on to be an eating disorder because now it's helping you cope with more and more and more things. And you also feel disconnected from a sense of comfort without it because you had no person. If you had had a person, do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So
I know this is about eating disorders, but I saw that with substance abuse.
Yes.
I mean, and I could end up all twisted up with drugs and alcohol mm-hmm. in the hospital on an overdose, which I did. And all of that was, you know, not knowing what was going to happen with any combination was safer
right.
than relying right. on another human being.
Right.
Yeah. And then when it got to food, right, then I can kind of, you know, I don't have to worry about ending up like in an overdose. Mm-hmm. You can kind of regulate it to yourself, you know, and right. as it's taking your legs out from underneath you.
Right.
And
right.
it's serving that adaptive purpose of defense and protection.
Right, which people needed to have done with for you when you were younger. Mm-hmm. And I also just want to say that people with eating disorders come from all backgrounds. You could have right. a family with a ton of mental health problems, right? Or you could have a family that's very intact. What's important to know is that 50 to 80% of why somebody goes on to an eating disorder has to do with genetics. It's not, you know, it's not random, and it's mm-hmm. not just having a bad family. Families don't cause eating disorders. Patients don't cause them. There's lots of roads that come together. But I wanted to say that out loud because, you know, Robin and Jen come from very different backgrounds, and both of them ended up right. having an eating disorder. Mm-hmm. So genes and environment both play a role in that.
I wish we had more time. We're down to our last minute. Genevieve and Robin, 15 seconds each. How are you doing now? How's your recovery going?
Awesome. I've finally graduated. I'm working. And the last thing I would like to say is that recovery is painful. But if anyone who's listening right now has an eating disorder and is even thinking about reaching out, I would totally do it because my worst day right now is a million times better than my best day with my eating disorder.
Congratulations. Good, good for you. Good. And thank you for sharing your story. That means so much. Robin.
I just say it's an ongoing
seconds.
Process. It's
yeah.
an ongoing process.
Absolutely. We'll schedule another
one. A worthwhile one.
Good, good. We have a lot more to talk about. I'm sorry we're out of time. I want to thank Mary Tantillo, Michelle Morales, Robin Giuliano, and Genevieve Morrow. Also my colleague John Andrus in the booth, our engineer this week. Evan Dawson will be back with us on Monday. I'm Megan Mack. Have a great weekend, everyone, and thank you for listening to Member Supported Public Radio.